You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Well, thank you all for coming. Let me begin by introducing myself. I'm Bill Galston, a senior fellow in the Governance Studies Division here at Brookings. And let me explain the genesis of this event. I'm involved in a number of different activities here at Brookings. One of them is a book series called Governing Ideas, which is an occasional discussion series of books that seem to present large ideas about how human beings organize and govern themselves. And this event is in part the latest installment in that series. I'm also one of the co-directors of a Brookings project on religion, politics, and public life. And this book also fits very neatly into that category. And so the confluence of these two programs has produced this event, plus full confession. I know Mr. Wolf reasonably well and have gotten to know Yehuda Kurtzer through the Hartman Institute. At any rate, I'm delighted to welcome you to what I suspect will be a searching discussion of Alan Wolf's book, At Home in Exile. And let me introduce both of the participants and explain the order of events very quickly. You have full biographies in your written packets, and so I'm not going to waste time by repeating what you can read for yourselves. Suffice it to say that Alan Wolf is professor of political science and director of the Boise Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. He's the author and editor of more than 20 books, including the one that we're here to discuss today. He's done all sorts of things. Many of you may have gotten to know him in his capacity as an extraordinary book reviewer for the New Republic, a relationship that lasted for a very long time. Yehuda Kurtzer is president of the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America. He has a doctorate in Jewish studies from Harvard, an MA in religion from Brown, and he's the author of a very interesting book called Teshuva, The Future of the Jewish Past, a work of constructive theology that offers new thinking on how contemporary Jews can and should relate to our past while living profoundly in the present. And for those of you who are not acquainted with the Hartman Institute, either its branch in North America or the mothership in Jerusalem, I would urge you to acquaint yourselves with it because it is one of the most vital and interesting centers for the exploration of the Jewish tradition in relationship to the profoundest problems of Jews in modernity. The order of events will be roughly as follows. Alan Wolf will present the main themes of his book in no more than 25 minutes. Yehuda Kurtzer will have 20 minutes to offer a commentary. There will then be a brief moderated colloquy between the two of them, and the remaining half hour or so will be given over to your questions and responses from our panel. So, without further ado, Alan Wolf.
Thanks so much, Bill, for that introduction and acknowledgement of our longstanding friendship. One thing an author just absolutely hates to do is to possibly lose an audience. So, Bill, I see more people than chairs. Is it possible to get a few? Okay. Well, okay. Well, Bill Galston kindly referred to the fact that I've kind of written a lot of books in my life, and I sometimes think that maybe it's too many. You know, there are other things you can do with your time than write some 20 books. But then I think about a man named Jacob Neusner, a great writer on Jewish subjects, who's probably written about 80 or 85. I think he comes in second in all time to God in the number of books written by a scholar of Jewish studies. And so I'm going to begin with a reference to Jacob Neusner, who's written to the effect that in the last 60 or 70 years, the years that have taken place since those two cataclysmic events happened so closely together, the Holocaust in Germany and then the creation of Israel in 1948, he writes that it was inevitable that these two events would shape how post-World War II Jews would think. And he insists that in this period, 60 or 70 year period, a period as it happens that corresponds almost exactly with my life. I was born in 1942, 6 years before Israel, and as the Holocaust was picking up steam, that the conjunction of these two events really created essentially a new religion for Jews, primarily in the diaspora, but I think also to some extent in the Holy Land. And he calls it the Judaism of Holocaust and Redemption. He says it's very, very different from the Judaism of the Torah. In some ways, it resembles Christianity historically more than Judaism, because it gives us such a sharp and contrasting contrast between the hell of Hitler and the heaven of Israel. That with Hitler, the Jews met a form of evil unprecedented in the history of the world, far worse than anything John Milton may have depicted as the Christian hell in Paradise Lost. A living, breathing Satan, whose danger that he posed to the Jewish people and to the world was probably unprecedented in human history. And so you have this absolute horror of horrors. And then, lo and behold, it's followed shortly thereafter by the prospect of salvation through statehood. That statehood was the heaven for which the Holocaust was the hell. And that statehood for the Jewish people assumed an atmosphere of salvation, an atmosphere of redemption. The Zionists who created Israel may have been secular, but the meaning of statehood is transformed into religious terms as offering a possible better ending to a story that had such an awful beginning. Since these events corresponded so exactly with the years of my own life, I've been shaped by them like I think just about everybody has been. I'm one of those people that absolutely cannot stop reading every book I can find or every movie that I can attend about the Holocaust, obsessed with the Holocaust, and trying to figure out its meaning, writing other books about political evil and subjects like that. But it does occur to me that for all the power of this imagery of destruction and redemption, that this religion, the religion of Holocaust and redemption, unlike most religions, is time-bound. It's temporable. It's not a universal. It doesn't appeal to an endless ending. There is an ending. There will be an ending. And that is that when the impact of these two astonishing events begin to lose their grasp on our mental imagination, the linking of the two will have to pass and something else will have to replace it. I think that's essentially what's happening now, that things like the extensive Pew survey of American Jews shows that among younger Jews, consciousness of the Holocaust is diminishing, that the almost sacred attitude toward Israel is also diminishing. I think we're finding ourselves in a world in which we need a new way of understanding the role that Jews play for themselves and for the rest of the world. One can lament this, and some writers have. I think primarily of a very, very interesting professor of Jewish studies at Indiana University in Bloomington named Alvin Rosenfeld, who's written about how the passing of the Holocaust memory would be a tragedy, that the Holocaust was not a sort of generalized lesson of evil in general. It was a specific horror against the Jews, that it doesn't correspond to other genocides, and that when we lose that, we lose something precious. It's an attitude I can well understand. but it also seems to me to assign to the Jews a perpetual and an inevitable victimization, essentially a negative, defensive, protective outlook on the world. And I would much rather prefer that the transition from this world in which the Holocaust and the birth of Israel created the beginning and the ending of the story, that Jews instead turn back to a tradition that has been part of their history, really since Maimonides, but was particularly emphasized in 19th century Enlightenment thought in Berlin and then taken to the United States, a tradition of a more universal and universalistic understanding of the Jewish mission. Now, universalism and particularism are frequently used as ways of describing contrasting Jewish attitudes toward Jews toward themselves and toward others. There are numerous scholars who have proven that these terms are hopeless to use, that you can't really define them, that one blends into the other, and so on. And I think all of that is true. And yet I find myself unable to not use them. I think, as I try to understand these things, there really are two basic different attitudes that have persevered throughout Jewish history since the book of Deuteronomy was written. And one sees the dispersion, the dispersal of Jews around the world, as a punishment that God has imposed upon their sins primarily of forgetting God or of ignoring God or putting other gods before him. Diaspora as punishment, and one, diaspora as dispersion, as a positive thing that has happened to the Jews because a relatively enlightened religion associated with Judaism can be spread to the world as a whole and not just confined to the Jewish people. These have fought back and forth with each other for a very, very long time. It was inevitable, I think, that the Holocaust and the creation of Israel would turn the tide in a particularist direction. Hitler himself was particularist. He did choose other people than the Jews to massacre and eliminate, but the Jews were in particular his enemy and in particular the people that he singled out. And Israel also singled out Jews as to provide them a home and to provide them a safe place. So that conjunction of events, I don't think there was any choice but for Jews to think more particularistically as long as those events shaped their consciousness. In a post-Holocaust, post-birth of Israel world, however, I think the time is ripe for a return of the more universalistic traditions within Judaism, the kind that came, for example, from Rabbi David Einhorn, born in Bavaria, ultimately understood Judaism as an obligation to spread the seeds of enlightenment around the world, moved to Baltimore, Maryland, just as the Civil War was breaking out, had to flee his pulpit in Baltimore because of his anti-slavery teachings, had two daughters, both of whom married the sort of number one and number two prominent Reform Jews in the United States, and who spread this mission of an Enlightenment kind of Judaism around the whole country, influencing rabbis generation to generation. That kind of message, I think, is due for a revival. And so the main argument of my book is to look at various developments that are happening in Judaism and in the Jewish community that could return us to this really important, but I think somewhat underappreciated tradition over the last 60 or 70 years. In that context, I try to address a number of the things that worry diaspora Jews, like the intermarriage rate, which is indeed very high among Jews. And I try to argue against a sort of doom and gloom mentality associated with it, that if Hitler didn't kill all the Jews, the Christians they marry will, that there's no fundamental difference between trying to kill Jews and trying to love them. In a sense, they're both bent on the extermination of Judaism. One of the heroes of the book was a man who grew up in Lithuania and died in Waltham, Massachusetts, named Simon Ravidovich. a man who I think understood so much of the dilemma that Jews face around the world today, who wrote extensively in his time about the problem that Jews who made Aliyah to Israel would face with the Arab, who wrote as a kind of old-fashioned Jewish prophet and called Jews to live, not just to live, but to live up to an ideal. I try to bring to life in the book other voices. I particularly focus on a writer like Simon Dubnow, the sort of great historian of the Jewish people after Heinrich Ratz, who again was born in Europe. He never did come to the United States, but his wife Sophie did. She lived till she was 102 years old, became a very famous Jewish poet in New York. I actually had no idea at the time, but in the 1960s I attended a seminar at Columbia University, and one of the members was an economist of the Soviet Union named Alexander Ehrlich, and he turned out to be Dubnow's grandson, I wish I had known at the time when I knew him so well. So this is what the book's about. It uses a lot of different methods. There's some counting there. There's some intellectual history there. There's an attempt to reinterpret a chapter designed to show that there was not just one Zionist movement, but there are many kinds of Zionism, political Zionism, cultural Zionism, and so on. And for me, as a person who is not a professor of Jewish studies, who's not religious in any real sense of the term, a thoroughly secularized, Americanized Jewish boy from Philadelphia, to come to terms relatively late in life with a heritage that I never paid any attention to, and to try to make sense of it as best as I could for me and for you. That's what the book is about. So thank you very much for your attention.
Well, Alan, thank you so much. And your mention of Jacob Neusner reminded me that he is the subject of one of the better academic jokes I've ever heard. Apparently a friend of his called his office, and his secretary answered, and the friend asked to speak to Professor Neusner, and the secretary said, "Oh, I'm sorry, you can't. He's writing a book." To which the friend responded, "That's okay. I'll hold." Yehuda, the floor is yours.
First of all, it's a great honor to be here today. Thank you, Bill, for inviting me. Bill and I know each other through the Shalom Hartman Institute Philosophy Conference, which Bill runs at the Institute for many years. And, of course, it's an honor to be responding to Professor Wolff's important and provocative book. I do want to also acknowledge that in the context of a conversation about collective Jewish identity, it's a funny and sad day to be having that conversation in light of a terrorist attack that took place last night in Israel, this morning, this time. And so apropos of what I hope that we talk about today a little bit, I feel a little bit personally, I channel a little bit of the Yehuda Halevi, who you speak about in your book as the kind of the architect of Jewish particularism in the Middle Ages, in his famous line of, "I am in the my heart is in the East, and I am in the uttermost West." I want to start with a quote from the German Jewish philosopher Franz Rosenzweig, writing in the 1920s, who says as follows: "Zionism, diagnostician of genius, but most mediocre healer, has recognized the disease but prescribed the wrong treatment. What is recognized was the absence of a specific contemporary Jewish life having some common characteristics other than the just common possession of a dead scholarship called the Science of Judaism, which no one is familiar with, and the common defense against anti-Semitism." Rosenzweig goes on to say later in the chapter, "As soon as the great question is posed to us about what should be done now, and how new vessels of Jewish communal life are to be plated in this devastated but indestructible soil in place of the shrunken ones, so that grafting themselves onto these new vessels, individuals can again feel the sap of the old, eternally inexhaustible stream course through their arteries. As soon as this question is asked, Zionism fails us." Rosenzweig was responding to, in the 1920s, was in many ways the core two questions that modernity raised for the Jewish people, which animate a lot of Professor Wolff's book, which are emancipation and enlightenment. Once Jews become actually freed of the political structures that tie them to live in the context of ghettos in their own communities, and they're enabled to be free citizens of the societies in which they live. And simultaneously, once enlightenment takes over for the Jewish people and allows for the breakdown of the traditionalism that had kept Jews not just physically isolated, but in some ways intellectually isolated, the Jewish people, and have been asking this question for the last 250 years, what is the point of remaining or continuing to be Jewish? And in what ways are the various new mass movements, intellectual otherwise, going to help create a narrative by which Judaism is supposed to continue onwards? Rosenzweig's comments, provocative at the time and incredibly provocative almost 100 years later, suggest that Zionism comes along as one political solution to the quote-unquote Jewish problem, a term that Jews used for themselves before the Nazis used for Jews. The question of who are we supposed to be in the world and how are we supposed to act now that we can live freely in the societies that will have us as members and we can participate in the same intellectual culture as others without the prisons of intellectualism that we've created for ourselves. Rosenzweig responds to this political reality by saying, sure, Zionism acknowledges this problem by providing a solution for Jews to escape political anti-Semitism and to constitute our own culture in a particular place. But as he indicates, once it's actually posed as a question of meaning, who Jews are supposed to be, what are we supposed to do, Zionism fails us. And Rosenzweig, to his credit, is of course right. The fact that Jews wind up with the State of Israel means that they achieve a political success, but the fact that that State of Israel is still trying to work out what Jewishness is supposed to mean in the context of the State of Israel means that Zionism doesn't solve the Jewish problem except politically and not fully intellectually. Rosenzweig is aware that Zionism as a political ideology can't address the more significant question of what Jewishness is supposed to do for us in the world. It can solve a political problem, but not an existential one. But what's interesting about Rosenzweig's take here, and it'll echo with Professor Wolff's book, is that his prescription is not, the outcome that he provides is not a prescription towards universalism and abandonment of the particular Jewish tradition, but that same critique of Zionism actually generates for Rosenzweig a turn inwards. It's part of a book that's called On Jewish Learning, and it's part of a document that means to animate the creation of the Lehrhaus, a new institution of Jewish learning created in Germany in the 1920s, that but for the demise of German Jewry on the one hand and the demise of Rosenzweig to ALS himself, would have had, well, one can imagine, a long and illustrious history. In other words, for Rosenzweig, the critique of Zionism comes not with the response, if this political ideology doesn't solve the Jewish problem for us, how do we turn outwards? But actually, he used the same question to demand a turn inwards. And the turn of phrase that he uses later in the book, which is so suggestive and that I want to come back to, is that the present moment requires an investment in the creation of what he calls Jewish human beings. How do we make people into Jewish human beings? It's an incredibly powerful term because it captures precisely the tension that's played out so intensively in the book of Jewish as a particular designation and human being as a universal designation. For Rosenzweig, the answer to this problem was not by choosing particularism or choosing universalism, but by trying to integrate the two and channel the two into a more comprehensive identity, that particularism would become a vessel for universalism and not a substitute for it. There's a lot I admire and embrace in this remarkable book, including five key ideas that I think the book represents and articulates very powerfully that have significant political ramifications, and I hope they get further press. One, the willingness to stand up, as you do in the book, to not just the classical but the continued subtle negation of the diaspora that continues to animate American Jewish life, including the really problematic ways that our Jewish community oftentimes uses Israel as a proxy or a shortcut for meaningful Jewish identity. Since the 1967 war, American Jewish self-definition changes, and American Jews stand up proudly and think of themselves very differently. But sometimes the more nefarious representation of this is when more educational resources in the Jewish community go towards sending Jewish kids to Israel than they go into Jewish educational institutions of the diaspora. We sometimes use Israel as a proxy for or a substitute for actually amounting a credible claim about our own identity. Second, another admirable idea in the book, a significant critique of the cult or culture of anti-Semitism as a self-serving instrument to Jewish pride and Jewish identity in spite of what we can only call dramatically changed circumstances for the Jewish experience in America. I think you rightly acknowledge in the book there continues to persist to be anti-Semitism. It appears differently in different parts of the world. But the American Jewish experience, especially over the last half century, has resulted in a totally different experience for Jews today of what it means to be an American. And the continued insistence in some quarters of Jewish communal leadership that we should stay Jewish because of anti-Semitism, the continued persistence of a narrative of anti-Semitism as defining what it means to be Jewish today is, I agree with you, in some ways an unethical shortcut to identity that doesn't require of us to seriously think about what it means to be Jewish. It just allows us to rely on the fact that as long as they still hate us, we still have something meaningful to say in the context of our own community. A third big idea you play out in the book, which I identify with very much, is the possibility of a new non-hierarchical Israel diaspora relationship. You mentioned to Ravidovich. And Ravidovich famously imagines that instead of thinking that there's, on this hierarchy, Israel is the center and diaspora is the periphery, that rather two communities or multiple communities can function in an elliptical relationship, drawing strength from the relationship to one another, but not resulting in a hierarchy. In my own research, I like to go back to a different golden age in Jewish history and one that doesn't get enough press, which is the golden age of the Jewish community of Alexandria in Egypt. Again, at a time prior to the destruction of the Second Temple, when Jews were living in a voluntary diaspora, they had a choice to go to the land of Israel and live where the temple was and elected not to, and produced phenomenal literature, architecture, interpretation of the Bible that reflected their desire to, on one hand, be in relationship to the Jews of the land of Israel, and on the other hand, to not allow their identity to be defined entirely by it. A fourth great term you use in the book is the secularization of particularism. It's a good one. It's a keeper. This is a very... What's that?
You're the first person to notice.
Oh, yeah, I like that a lot. It's also tweetable. The secularization of particularism suggests that whereas particularism once may have been a religious ideology of believing that we are together as a people because of religious terms or ethical behaviors, secularizing it, and to borrow a phrase from my colleague Professor Shaul Magid, replaces significant Jewish secularism, which was a very strong ideology for a long time, with pro-Israelism. Right? It makes particularism a political ideology rather than a substantive ideology. I think this is an incredibly profound and important idea that needs to be pushed out there. But perhaps what I appreciate most about the book, and then I'm going to offer a challenge, is the fundamental optimism of the book. Right? You make the case very strongly that we as a community must move beyond a narrative of crisis, right? Of enemies at the gates, the deterioration or collapse of either our own communities or those on the outside, an embrace of intermarriage as a reflection of the fact that for the first time in our history, people are not just not trying to kill us, but they actually want to be part of us, as you alluded to. A willingness to embrace present realities rather than tilting against them. Suggesting that instead of looking at the great problems that we face, and I think it's fair to say that the problems that the American Jewish community face today are the best problems that the Jewish people have ever had, that instead of fighting against those problems, we accept an understanding of the Jewish people for who they are, rather than in some ways wishing that we were otherwise. And I find a lot of public policy in the Jewish community tries to tell people to stop being who they are, instead of understanding who they are and providing resources to build a rich and meaningful Jewish life. And in all of these ways, I think you've convincingly argued the subtitle of your book that diaspora is in fact good for the Jews. But there's an itch of sorts in the narrative that you portray on universalism and particularism that I want to try to scratch today, that I struggled with as I was reading through the book and I want to address. And namely, I think your insistence throughout the book that these two poles are opposite to one another, that we have a choice between particularism and universalism. And the irony as a result is that many of the people who you critique in the book for being adamant in their particularism, you wind up actually aligning with. because you've conceded the point that particularism and universalism are opposite to one another, and you just take one side rather than the other. And what the reason this jumped out at me is that it signaled that you've told the story as entirely a modern Jewish story through the prism of a modern experience that has created political realities that make it seem obvious that these are opposite to one another. As a result, Zionism in your narrative becomes associated with particularism, and diaspora becomes associated with universalism. Moreover, Zionism, particularism, and kind of lack of moral imagination are on one side. Diaspora, universalism, and moral possibility are on the other. And my instinct, perhaps because of my own training, is to take a little bit of an older view throughout Jewish intellectual history and to try to explore further into the Jewish past and the Jewish canon and how these terms come into being. I tend to read the Bible, and this is going to be like the Bible in 30 seconds. I tend to read the Bible through the metaphor of an hourglass. The opening narrative of the Bible is the creation of a human being in the image of God, not the creation of a Jew, but rather the belief that God, what God wanted to do was to create a human being who would replace God on earth, right, and live out a moral universal vision without any distinction or differentiation between human beings. That for the first 11 chapters of Genesis, God attempts to do that and realizes that even if God is a universal God, you can't actually convey morality through that universal sensibility. And the hourglass begins to narrow through the selection, or if you prefer, election, of a particular human being, a particular family, that of Abraham, who is charged not to be particular in the closed sense of the word, but to actually carry out the universal mission on behalf of the rest of the world. That's why Abraham is told, I know that your responsibility is to be the ambassador for trust, for justice and righteousness. And why Abraham, in his selection, is also told that as a result, if you do what you're supposed to do in the world, the rest of the world will be blessed by you. Much of the rest of the Bible is the narrowing of this hourglass as the Jewish people become concerned with their particular family story and surround that story with a set of ethical obligations about what they're supposed to do. By the time you get to the end of the Bible, however, the hourglass reopens. And the critique of the prophets, ultimately, is that the people have become so obsessed with their particularism that they've forgotten that that particularism was meant to be an instrument for universalism. All right, so imagine that the story of the Bible starts as a universal challenge of what Jews are supposed to seek in the world. It becomes particular, and by the end of the Bible, we get a critique that is insufficiently universal. The moral quest of universalism I share with you. I think that's what Jewishness is supposed to make us do in the world. I think it's supposed to be a particular identity that's supposed to enable us to be the ambassadors or the architects of a model of justice and righteousness that is possible beyond the limitations of our own community. But what I would challenge you is that I think that this moral challenge runs through particularism and not around it. That a lot of the institutions that you ultimately talk about in the last chapter of the book, the new forms of prayer communities, of study communities, Hadar, Limud, even my own institution, the Shalom Hartman Institute, are really actually attempts to do this twofold thing, in many ways what Rosenzweig was trying to do with his Lehr House. That the creation of the Jewish human being was an effort to fortify particularism, not as an end in of itself, not so that Jews would turn particularism into chauvinism. And here I think you're completely right. It's not particularism intended to be an end in and of itself, but how else does someone achieve a lofty vision of what they're attempting to do in the world except through community, through friends, and through colleagues, and through kin? Particularism is an instrument to universalism, and the metric or the barometer always should be, are we living up to the best of what our moral tradition is compelling us to do? There is a trap door when one invests too much in particularism, which is chauvinism. But just because there's a trap door doesn't mean it may not be, at the end of the day, a more effective instrument to achieve the same moral values that you're trying to achieve. So I resist the belief that universalism is moral and particularism is self-interested. I think if that's the case, you're probably doing both of them wrong. Particularism always has to be a self-interested attempt to achieve a moral outcome. And if all you have done is separate these two, I don't think either of them has done as effectively as it should. I started with Rosenzweig because I think the knowledge, the authenticity and community that he was talking about that needed to be bred as an alternative response to Zionism is the means by which the Jewish people could achieve something in the world. And here I think the last piece that I'll say. When we take these pieces together, when we take an investment in Jewish ideas and authenticity, when we take the creation of Jewish community, whether in Israel or whether it's in diaspora, and we use community and particularism as the instrument to try to achieve something morally universal, we create the possibility not of one morally significant community which is in diaspora and one morally inferior community, that is the particular community in Israel, but we take on the possibility of two centers of Jewish life who are achieving this moral universalism in unprecedented ways. In other words, why must the result of this narrative be a kind of diminishment of Israel in order to promote diaspora? And instead, why don't we acknowledge that the present moment, the success, the affluence, the cultural penetration of Jews in America, and simultaneously a thriving sovereign state of Jewish political power in the state of Israel, simultaneously provide the opportunity for more universalism as a Jewish message than the Jewish people have ever had before? Couldn't a diaspora Jew look at the present moment in the state of Israel and realize that the state of Israel today, I'm not saying it always lives up to this, but the state of Israel today provides the single biggest engine for the possibility of tikkun olam, the single biggest possible engine for repair of the world, for this universal mission that you're talking about, than Jews have ever made possible before? I guess my hope at the end of the day, reading your book, is that we take this book, the challenge that you've laid forth about diaspora, to more seriously acknowledge the strengths and possibility that are at our disposal as diaspora Jews. But at the same time, I hope we don't take this book to the fullest extent to imagine that seeking of moral universalism is only of a moral vision is only possible through the abandonment of our particular tradition, but rather is fortified, is made stronger through an investment in the particularism. That the moral universal vision that we want to both see for the world is possible through particular community in diaspora, as well as through particular community in the state of Israel. Thank you.
Well, Yehuda, thank you for what I think many people will regard as a model of how to do a commentary on a book. Thank you. Alan, the floor is available for whatever response you want to make. Then I have a question or two to put to the two of you, and then it'll be your turn.
Thanks so much. You never know when you write a book what the reaction is going to be. I wrote a book about American Christianity once, and it turned out that the most right-wing Christians in the country loved it. You just never know what's going to happen. And I was warned with this book that the ultra-Orthodox were going to love my book because the ultra-Orthodox were historically against the creation of the State of Israel, and they would, you know, this would resonate with at least certain trends. I was extremely anxious before I came here about what the Shalom Hartman Institute would think about it, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate that you found such positive things in the book. It just, as a book launch, I couldn't have asked for anything more. I also found your remarks critical of the book extremely eloquent and very, very thoughtful. My only problem was I didn't think that I was as much given to that dichotomizing as you suggest. Just a few examples. I have the chapter on the three great defenders of diaspora, Rabinovich, Dubnov, and Ahad Ha'am, and in all three cases, I say that it was their deep immersion in the particular traditions that enabled them to have a more universalistic kind of vision. You mentioned some examples. I mean, whatever one thinks of my fellow graduate of Central High School in Philadelphia named Noam Chomsky, whatever you think of him, he's deeply rooted in a very famous Jewish family, a very famous tradition of Jewish scholarship, and even his rather peculiar criticisms of Israel, which are not, you know, one state solution kind of criticism, I think blend that particularism and universalism as well. I ultimately think you're absolutely right. It will be some kind of combination. I think the difference really is my combination is different than your combination. But I see absolutely no reason why I couldn't share in your conclusion about Israel and the diaspora and the relationship. When I prepared for questions that I might get about this book, no one has ever asked the following questions, but I've had an answer for it so long that I'm going to give you the answer. Professor Wolf, in an ideal world, if you could create it, what would be the proper distribution of Jews around the world between the homeland and the diaspora? And I would have said roughly half in Israel and roughly half in the rest of the world, and that's exactly what we have. And I think that is actually an ideal solution for a very, very complicated dilemma, which symbolizes, you know, what you're doing. So I say at one point in the book that just as the diaspora support of Israel in the early years was primarily financial, I don't think it's financial support that now would be the best contribution the diaspora could make to a healthy and vibrant Israel, but an ethical support. I'm somewhat pessimistic about how that would go over. I'm sensitive to the fact that it's advice coming from abroad, that most of us Jews here in the diaspora have not served in the army. We've not lost people to terrorist acts and so on. And so it's somewhat gratuitous of us to give ethical advice. In the conclusion of the book, I read a very, very powerful commentary from probably the most distinguished Israeli in my particular line of work, Shlomo Avineri, who basically argued that it's up to us in Israel, the diaspora can give everybody, you know, it's our decision, we have to make the decision. But I also read a very interesting response to his Haaretz essay by a young Israeli who had originally come from England, was educated at Balliol College at Oxford, where I once taught, who said, no, we really do need the diaspora. And that's sort of the view that I'm inclined to do. So I try to walk a lot of lines in the book, but, you know, I don't want the book to be read as supportive of boycott, divestment, sanctions, or MondoWeiss.com, the anti-Zionist thing. And my own personal identity is with a kind of liberal Zionism. I know that there was the op-ed in the New York Times that my dear friend Tony Lehrman, the British Jew, wrote the end of liberal Zionism. There won't be any. I very much object to that and so on. But I, you're right to sense a difference. I see it more of a difference of degree than of kind.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And perhaps what we're talking about is nuance, quality, and detail, and not necessarily what I heard in the book as a serious dichotomy between these two may not have been as strong as you're articulating. I guess the one edit I would say to what you just said is I'm not sure how comfortable I am again with what diaspora Jews owe to Israel is ethical as opposed to philanthropic, because again, to me, that conveys some sensibility that there's an ethical privileging of diaspora Jews because of the absence of living under sovereignty than there is for Jews under sovereignty. What I would be more interested in is actually a discursive relationship between Israeli Jews and diaspora Jews about the ways in which the two experiments under which we're living. One is power connected to sovereignty, and one is power of belonging that's not explicitly sovereign, and finding ways to structure what could ultimately both be an ethical, structural, and functional conversation, a kind of a more discursive relationship than what sounds to me almost like a reaffirmation of a hierarchical relationship by imagining that one community has something to say ethically that the other community is incapable of doing.
Well, I think that's right, and I would confess to. I think that Israeli actions, primarily with respect to the settlers and other kinds of issues that I don't think we need to go into, have given me a sense that they've taken ethically backward steps that are very disastrous and need some, if it's, you want to call it hierarchy, yes. The whole point of diaspora to me is that you learn something about being in a minority when you're in the diaspora, and the danger of being in the majority, as Jews are in Israel, is that they lose that kind of, so I would confess to a two-step or a hierarchy, as you call it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although being strangers in Mitzrayim didn't do much for our ethical sensibility, as I recall. But let me, let me, if I may, just spend a couple of minutes probing two questions that I think are of particular interest in the book, two quasi-theoretical questions that the particularity of the narrative in the book raises. The first of these questions was triggered by Yehuda's very interesting turn of phrase when he advocated and wished for, and I quote, a non-hierarchical relation between Israel and the diaspora. What's interesting about one of the many things that's interesting in this book is the refusal of so many of the players in the book to agree to that idea of a non-hierarchical relationship, because ultimately it comes down to a question of what is the best way to live a Jewish life. Mm-hmm. And this is not, it seems to me, a question that can be so easily evaded. And let me just give you a couple of, you know, two or three examples in the book. You know, the twice mentioned Professor Neusner, you quoted in your book as saying, America is a better place to be a Jew than Jerusalem. You know, lapidary words, but, you know, a pretty strong assertion. And then towards the end of the book, you quote someone who I guess is now a German Jew by the name of Tamara Benema, who says the diaspora is good.
Dutch,
I'm sorry. Diaspora is good for everyone. It makes you more of a mensch if you're not defined by Boden, that is to say, soil. So once again, the ethical superiority of living in exile, a better, fuller, human, more human life in exile. And then we come to perhaps the most famous Zionist of all, David Ben-Gurion. And here's what Ben-Gurion has to say, classically. Only in the state of Israel is a full Jewish life possible. And he goes on to explain exactly what he means in classic theoretical terms. He says, a whole Jew and a whole man without any split or division between the citizen and the society. Rousseau couldn't have said it better than that. Okay, so I guess my question is, and it's a question to the two of you, you know, do the two of you refuse that debate, or do you situate yourself along that continuum or within that conversation, but without necessarily coming to the one or the other as your settled point of view?
You know, part of the reason I think I found myself in the right place is that those polemics are useful educationally, but are very hard to relate to as being effective means of actually crafting out the conversation of what does a good Jewish life mean, right? They help to situate a debate as the poles of the superiority of the diaspora or the poles of the superiority of living in the land of Israel, but they actually misrepresent the complexity that comes with a full and rich Jewish identity. Part of what I was trying to push back with respect to the book is the belief that that any hierarchy must exist between these places, and that means not just correcting for the classical hierarchy of the superiority over the land of Israel over the diaspora, but making sure that we don't slip so far in the other direction as believing that that living in America affords us some sort of ethical superiority or religious advantage over living in the land of Israel. One of the things that's been so interesting to watch with Israelis over the past 25 to 30 years is the when there is actually a discursive relationship between Israeli Jews and diaspora Jews, Judaism changes in both places. A kind of classic site or locus of this has been the question of, is Jewishness a private phenomenon or a public phenomenon? Where for a long time, the model was for diaspora Jews that Jewishness was a phenomenon of the household, the community center, or the synagogue. You know, this is the Zionist poet Yehuda Leib Gordon, the longing in the late 19th century was to be a Jew at home and a human being on the street. That's the diaspora vision. And the state of Israel provided an opportunity for what you might call public space Jewishness, in which Jewishness is how you create a national calendar. It's how you have national holidays and so on. It's the days of the week, but you don't need the private institutions. Now, when the debate stays there, you lend yourself to a hierarchy, because one side will claim synagogues are better than a calendar, and the other side, the A.B. Yehoshuas, the David Ben-Gurions, and others, will say the national fabric of the society is fuller and richer than just being Jewish in the privacy of your home and in your synagogue. But what's been so interesting to watch over the last 30 years is that these phenomena are bleeding into one another, so that American Jews are acting like Israelis in the American public square. Why it's no longer, it was a scandal in the 70s when Jews started lighting Hanukkah menorahs in public parks, and now it's just normal, right? That we've actually begun to become public Jews in ways that Israelis are. And Israeli Jews are in very clear and explicit ways reclaiming the privatized model of Jewishness, because it's insufficient to say, I just want to be Jewish through the calendar. Do I actually have content, richness, books, and texture to make my Jewishness possible? So when you actually get away from the hierarchical poles and actually create a discursive conversation between Israeli Jews and American Jews, you find the possibility of the rearticulation of these values in much more complex hybrid ways. And that's what I personally just find not only a more ethical conversation, but a more interesting conversation.
Well, I have a couple of possible responses. One is that I tried as best as I could to find out if the same question is asked by other groups. I have a colleague at Boston College named Kevin Kenney, who's a distinguished historian of the Irish diaspora. And I asked him this, and he said he couldn't think of anything comparable in Ireland to the negation of the diaspora concept or this hierarchical relationship. I asked scholars of India who told me that Indian identity in the 20th century has been so shaped by novelists living in Toronto and London. And so I can't really find a kind of comparable example where this question is debate, you know, is it, can you lead a more thoroughly Greek life? I know we have met somebody at lunch from Greece. Can you lead a more thoroughly Greek life here than you can in Greece? Maybe, you know, that maybe the answer to that's obvious. I just don't know enough about the subject. So I know at one level that this is a question that would face any diaspora, a Greek word, by the way, and that the Jewish diaspora is not the only diaspora in the world. The other thing I would say is I don't think there's a theoretical answer to your question. If you had asked me this question in the early 1950s, even when Ben-Gurion made that statement that I would so disagree with, to me, Israel would have been a socialist or at least social democratic experiment dominated by labor Zionists who themselves had grown out of a universalistic vision. Herzl himself was a universalist and so on. It would have been a very, very different Israel. And I probably back in that days would have said something like, my God, look at this experiment. It's absolutely amazing. This is the first time Jews have ever had something. Let's listen to them. They have things to teach us. But I look at the Israel of today, which is increasingly becoming a Middle Eastern country in the Middle East rather than a European outpost in the Middle East, and think of it however you want, you know, it's a different kind of Israel. And in that context today, the question again would be totally context. For you quoted it, you know, is it better to be a Jew in New York than in Jerusalem? Well, for a Reformed Jew married to another Reformed Jew who want to raise Reformed Jewish children, absolutely it would be better to be in New York than in Jerusalem. From a more Orthodox Jew, the answer might be different. I don't know. But again, I just can't come up with one general answer that would apply to all cases. For someone like me, if you even want to consider me Jewish, I know where I can lead the kind of life that I need. But it's a peculiar life. It's a life that recognizes my Judaism, but not in any real religious sense, and only vaguely even in an ethnic sense, but still can't let go of it. You know, every time I'm classical music fanatic, and I'll go to hear a performance of a Handel oratorio based on text from the Old Testament, and I'll just, you know, I'll get all goosebumpy. That's my tradition, so it's hard to, you know.
Well, I would simply observe that at least as the question is posed in your book by these quotations, it really goes to the heart of the worth of liberalism, okay? Because what Ben-Gurion refuses is the defining principle of a liberal order. namely a separation between the public and the private between state and society. And I do think it is a question that can't be easily evaded, whether a full Jewish life is best situated within a liberal order or within an order in which, to be blunt, there is a state religion and it happens to be Judaism. Here's my second question, then it's your turn. There is, you know, there is a wonderful moment in this book when you quote the late Christopher Hitchens, you know, who discovered that he was halachically Jewish very late in life, disturbingly late in life, though there are parallels among secretaries of state. I mean, it's, you know, it's
new.
It's. I think it's just wonderful that John Kerry is the great great grandson of the Maharal of Prague. But go figure. Adam Sandler, we need you. At any rate, Christopher Hitchens, you quote as saying, as referring to, the important but delayed realization will have to come, : Israeli Jews are part of the diaspora, not a group that has escaped from it. Now, if that's correct, then, of course, the basic polarity of the book will have to be rethought completely. But I just to tee this up a little bit, let me read a quotation to the same effect. The establishment of the State of Israel is the most profound modification of the Galut which has occurred, but it is not the end of the Galut. In the religious sense, and perhaps not only in the religious sense, the State of Israel is part of the Galut. Now, those of you with rhetorically sensitive ears will have recognized that as a statement from the late Leo Strauss, but it appears to me to be very much along the same lines as Christopher Hitchens. So, what do you understand Hitchens and by extension Strauss to be saying, when he makes that argument, which you appear to have some sympathy with?
Well, I don't know what was in the mind of either gentleman when they wrote that. It resonated with me for two reasons. One is that we now have a situation that I think most of the early Zionists could never have imagined, and that is people in Zion fleeing for the diaspora. Israeli Jews in New York, Israeli Jews in Berlin. Inconceivable, I think. Once you posit the idea that Israel is the only place for Jews to live, as Zionists like Ben Gurion did, that Jews would voluntarily have that privilege and then give it up seems inconceivable. But I think the more general meaning is that the security that statehood seemed to offer, we now know that Jews are a majority in Israel but a severely threatened minority in the Middle East. And because Israel is in the Middle East, you never escaped the diaspora after all. It depends upon how wide your geographic scope is. But, as you say, this sort of challenges some of the ideas in the book. But it all depends on that dual fold. If you look just at Israel, Jews have their own state, and it should be a secure one because that's what state offer. But if you look at the Middle East, the security disappears. And therefore, the Israeli Jews are facing exile. They're facing exile in the Middle East more generally.
I'll just say two quick responses. One is to go back to my Rosenzweig quote, which Hitchens affirms, which is that Zionism does not solve the problem for the Jewish people. It provides a political alternative from not living under sovereignty. And here I'm reminded of that you quote Yishai Leibovich, the great kind of Israeli chemist slash philosopher and kind of great curmudgeon of the late 20th century in Israel, who says that Zionism for him is not an ideological movement, but it is the ability not to be ruled over by goyim. So Zionism doesn't solve for that; only solves that problem. It doesn't solve the big kind of larger challenge of what Judaism is supposed to mean in the world. And in some ways, Leibovich aligns with that reading that says we're still part of the same. No dramatic condition, no messianic condition has come to save us from the challenges that we face, even if we now get to actually be in charge. I would just put a note of caution on that, and I think this is an unexpected outcome that Hitchens wouldn't anticipate, which is the persistence of the ideology that would say that Israel is still diasporic or exilic, even as it's sovereign, is that it breeds an attitude towards foreign policy that is diasporic and exilic. that doesn't take full responsibility for what it means to actually be a sovereign state, but is obsessed with the enemies at the gates and our vulnerability and our weakness. And I don't want to say more about that because I don't want to, it is on the record, but I do think that a good bit of Israeli policy is too often crippled by that sensibility of insisting on being diasporic, even in the context of being sovereign, and forgetting what it means to actually rule as the sovereign.
Although, of course, I'm sorry.
Just one more word before we open up. I'm glad you brought up Leibovitz. She's the Orthodox Jewish pacifist, probably the greatest critic of Israelis' military policies, but from an Orthodox Jewish perspective. One of the things when you learn about the diaspora is all the connections. Everybody seems to be connected to everybody else. So Leibovitz grew up in Riga in Latvia, and he had the same Hebrew school teacher as the British philosopher Isaiah Berlin, and they were always being compared to each other as Berlin was the inferior pupil.
Well, I think we've probably teed up a lot of questions, and the last half hour, as promised, belongs to you. I will start with Norman Birnbaum and then move back.
Well, thanks to all three of you. I'm Norman Birnbaum from Georgetown University and The Nation magazine. Thanks to all three of you for immensely stimulating discussion with plenty of lines of enough lines of thought in it to generate any number of good university seminars. My question is a simple existential one. The assumption is that the state of Israel in one form or another will continue to exist and pose a problem for the diaspora. Suppose, however, that in the troubled Mideast, as we saw today, the existence of Israel as a Jewish state is simply impossible. What then for the diaspora?
Are you pointing at me?
I don't know. It's a hard question, so I'm pointing at you.
Since I shared Professor Wolf's optimism, I don't think the state of Israel is going away anytime soon, and I don't think its Jewish character as a Jewish state is going away anytime soon. If anything, what I'm more concerned about is the legislative efforts to affirm the Jewishness of the Jewish state in Israel, which I think are actually much more damaging to precisely the moral, liberal, universal qualities that that state is supposed to exhibit. So, I'm going to dodge the question a little bit by saying I'm not particularly concerned that that's going to happen, but at the risk of being portrayed as completely naive, what I would say is at one point in Jewish history, when there existed a temple and a sovereign Jewish people in one place and there existed a voluntary diaspora in another place, the nature of the gravitational relationship between those two places was such that when that center was destroyed, it had dramatic gravitational effects on the communities on the outside. I do believe that Jews in America are safer and prouder and more successful and more powerful and more affluent because of the state of Israel for reasons that are very difficult to unpack, and I believe the reciprocal is true. So I think that part of the reason for a continued sustained relationship between diaspora Jews and Israeli Jews is not merely because that's an ethical way of thinking about where half the Jews are and where the other half are and because we have relationships to one another, but because I think in very deep ways our fates are actually tied up to each other. So a serious cataclysmic act or event or transformation that took place either for diaspora Jews or for Jews in the state of Israel, I think would almost, by the laws of physics, have profound ramifications for the other.
I saw a couple of hands back here. Yes, sir, on the aisle, and then I'll move into the gentleman in the center and then the gentleman on the other aisle.
My name is Rafiq. My question is to Dr. Wolf. Your book, as I understand, explains the reasons why diaspora is suitable for Jews. You mentioned about, other speaker mentioned about the America. In America, there's, in 19th century, there was discrimination against Jews, even though there's no discrimination right now. In Europe, Jews experienced many waves of persecutions, pogroms in Russia, massacres in Dark Ages. So in Now I want to shift direction to other part. It's a small country, Muslim country in Azerbaijan, where Jews and Muslims lived in a harmony. I don't know whether you know about this. It's a small. They live in different villages or part of city. So my question is that did you ask yourself why in certain diasporas Jews survived the other part? They witnessed so many challenges. Thank you.
Thank you. I only mentioned this briefly, and I maybe should have gone into it in greater length, but the years in which I'm talking about, from the 1940s to the present, were years not only marked by the fact that Israel eventually was settled by roughly half the Jewish population, and the rest were in the diaspora, but that the entire nature of the diaspora changed to the point where you have to wonder if even diaspora is the right word. I mean, diaspora means a spreading out, a dispersion. But this diaspora from the 1940s has been heavily concentrated. Jews used to live essentially everywhere. In every country, there would be a Jewish community. In the Arab world, in Southeast Europe, no matter where you went, you would find a Jewish community of some sort. Now, the Jewish community in the world is heavily concentrated, almost entirely in North America and in Western Europe. So that's a change that somehow has to figure into the dynamics. But it's kind of beyond the scope of my particular book. I've certainly thought a lot about it, and I do touch on it in various ways. I touch upon the out-migration of the Jews of the Maghreb, both to France and to Israel. The fact that there are more Jews now living in France than there are in the former Soviet Union, in fact, in all the republics of the former Soviet Union combined, is from the larger standpoint of Jewish history a stunning, development, major development. But it's somewhat tangential to what I was talking about in the book.
Gentleman with the white hair in the middle of that aisle.
I like to ask the opposite of the first question. What if there were no diaspora? I assume this came about in a peaceful, non-traumatic way. Either all the Jews moved to Israel in the 1940s or all diaspora Jews became assimilated and lost their identity. And the Jews in Israel were the only Jews in the world. What would that do to the state of Israel?
I have to admit, I've never thought about it. No, I don't mean to put down your question. I would just need time to reflect. I just don't think I can come up with a quick answer. I, as a thought experiment question, I think it's a really interesting. I don't know if you can.
In the 1960s, sociologists were convinced that Orthodox Judaism was going to be gone within 30 years. In the 1980s, right, you talk about this in the book, there's one sociologist writes that within, 40 years there's going to be 10,000, I believe, and 72 Jews left in America. There's a long history of anticipating, and this is Rabinovitch's famous essay, The Ever-Dying People. There's a long history of anticipating our own demise and using that as a catalyst for creating public policy. I am just personally so skeptical of it that it's hard for me to enter into a space of thinking about assimilation as actually ending the presence of the Jewish community. I think a more useful theoretical is as the trends that Professor Wolf talks about in his book take root, of a more universalistically oriented Jewish community becomes the dominant paradigm for who American Jews are, as we have shifting sense of our own citizenship and so on, how does it change our relationship as American Jews institutionally and otherwise towards the state of Israel? And I think the evidence that that's taking place is pretty far underway. The decentralization of power structures in the American Jewish community is one. The rise of now multiple Israel lobbies, so that nobody really speaks for the organized Jewish community when it comes to Israel policy. Those are all reflections of the transformed nature of the American Jewish community, but it also is hard for me to imagine that the Jews are going away anytime soon.
I'm going to take one more question on this side, the gentleman on the aisle, and then I'm going to move over to this side.
Thank you. I'm Leon Weintraub. This question perhaps is related to the last one, but I was surprised that in all of the discussion, I didn't hear any value of the diaspora expressed in a geopolitical sense. And I'm talking about the role of the diaspora Jewish community in the United States, similar to the role of the Cuban-American community, the Armenian community, the Greek community, other communities. It seems this is a very significant role. It's hard to imagine the performance of the United States at the Security Council of the United Nations were it not for this effect. So I was just very surprised. Was this a deliberate attempt to put this off to one side? And it seems to me it was something that was hard to ignore.
I'm not sure it is ignored, but I guess for me, as the person who wrote the book, I was trying to raise new questions. And I think the question, at least as I heard your question, I may have heard it incorrectly, but you know, the role that diaspora Jews would play vis-a-vis American foreign policy, such equivalent to the way Cuban Americans play with respect to policy toward Castro, that was a question that's been explored, huge debates. You know, the Mearsheimer and Walt book generated all those kind of debates. And, you know, I just think those questions were addressed by others, not particularly satisfactorily, but nonetheless addressed.
I think you do, though, in the chapter on secularity of particularism, right? I think that the nature of that argument is that the kind of politically pro-Israel secular Jewish community has very much entrenched itself into a kind of narrative that their act of loyalty to the Jewish people is by being the kind of flank in the American Jewish community to enable support for Israel. And I think that's both the stated view of that community and the critique of it. Right? It's funny when those things actually align with each other. So I think that that's a piece, a little bit of the book, but it's not. In some ways, we didn't address it directly, but I think it's just a feature of what the nature of the American Jewish diaspora actually consists of.
Okay, as promised, I'm shifting over here. I'm going to start with there and then move to you and then move to you. And
I'm Sergei Kosteev, Financial University, Moscow, Russia. My question exactly about this book by Mearsheimer. So could you elaborate in what aspects he is wrong about Israel lobby? Thanks.
I think Yehuda Kurtz said it very, very well. One of the peculiarities of that book is that they claim that what they call Israeli lobby or Jewish lobby, or do they use both?
Israel lobby.
Israel lobby has inordinate power. But when the so-called lobby itself brags about how much money it raises and how many congressmen it can talk to, it says the same thing. I mean, it was such an odd controversy. I'm not sure to this day how to respond to it. I think part of the reason why it was so controversial was not what the book said, but the way it said it. I think the authors were probably right in a lot of what they said, but they were clearly aiming to be sensationalistic, and they generated a sensation.
I think there is also a legitimate critique to be offered of the translation of a political phenomenon into the conspiratorial framework of it being about the Jews. And the minute someone comes along and says the Jews are acting in X way that implies it's against the larger public interest and in some ways against their own self-interest as Jews in America on behalf of somewhere else, it plants the seeds of being insidious and conspiratorial when a sheer analysis of what it means to lobby on behalf of Israel, presenting that data doesn't have that. So it's a little bit to what Professor Wolf indicated, but it kind of reeked of classic anti-Semitic tropes of how Jewish power is organized and mobilized in ways that are at odds with the needs and interests of the dominant state in which they live. And, you know, there's too much good history on that conspiratorial language and how it's been used against Jews that that I don't befault those who gave that book a hard time.
Yes, sir.
From your universalistic and particularistic point of view, how would you characterize the growth of the Lubavitcher movement in this country. I lived for many years in Tampa, where there was one small Orthodox synagogue, a couple of Reformed and a conservative, and it is now surrounded by thriving Chabads. And this is, many other places have experienced this. The only place I couldn't find them was in Kigali, Rwanda, when I was looking for them. But what is this movement in those, in your terms, and what does it mean for Jewry?
It's a fascinating development. In many ways, you know, the fact that you can find people associated with the Lubavitch movement everywhere is itself a remarkable thing. Ultra-Orthodox Jews traditionally named themselves after the town they lived in, and that included the Lubavitches, who named themselves after a town in Russia. So there was a tremendous kind of localism, and still is, in part because of rules that you walk to shul and so on. There's a strong, geographically bounded characteristic of most ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities. And yet, they're now having missions all over. The most prominent case of the two people from East New York who were murdered in Mumbai. What are they doing in Mumbai was my sort of first reaction. I mean, that's kind of what got me to realize that what I have always thought of as a very geographically tied, specific religion was now becoming global. So that in itself, I think, changed. Also, there are, you know, all kinds of paradoxes emerge. Obviously, there's a preference for having many children, but there's also a conversion phenomenon. People are converting to ultra-Orthodoxy. Some of the most interesting scholars that I know have shown that people, women and men attracted to the 1960s and the counterculture were actually ripe candidates for, they're more like religious seekers, ripe candidates for, so it's a very complex, enormously complex movement. I wouldn't overemphasize its growth. Reform Judaism is also growing. The numbers still remain relatively small. Of course, the big change in Israel is someone that no one really predicted, because Ben-Gurion gave the special exemptions on the military and so on to the ultra-Orthodox, thinking, as we said earlier, that they were going to die out. So, you know, why not give them privilege? Boy, was that wrong.
I would just say there's the growth of the ultra-Orthodox more broadly, and then specifically Lubavitch as a subset of that. Whenever you have a phenomenon like this, the question I ask is it hardware or software? Meaning, is it the ideology of a particular version of Judaism, or is it the way in which they're going out spreading their message, right? So the ultra-Orthodox community is convinced it's hardware, that they have a certain countercultural way of life that enables them to be more stable, that's attractive in a climate in which Jewishness is actually being rattled by all of these points, by the diminishment of boundaries, so they're been able to rearticulate their boundaries. But I think a lot of it is software, and I think that's certainly the case with Lubavitch. The reason why they are successful on college campuses is because their outreach strategies are more welcoming, more warm than those of Hillel's. And there's a lot of reasons why. It has to do with they're mission-driven, they have a message, they welcome everybody in, there's no cost or barrier to entry. And as opposed to Hillel's, which almost by definition are cold spaces that are made up by those who are actually there. I would say the curriculum to think about this question is to think about to what extent is this the rise of an ideological movement that seems counter-cultural to the rest of Jewishness in America, and how much of it is really a good operating system that they've put into place in order to sustain themselves and grow.
Well, I have tried hard not to inject myself into this conversation, but as the father of a son who embraced ultra-Orthodoxy and lives it, and who studied on Har Nof, a hop, skip, and a jump from the very sad events of today. I think there's more hardware to it than your answer might suggest. The idea of an immersion in a tradition, that provides a structured arena for reflection and decision can be extremely attractive. But this would be a longer conversation. Yeah.
You've been very patient.
Quick comment and a question. Quick comment. I was in another meeting of something totally different this morning, and I was in probably in the upper 10% of age. Here I feel like I'm basically the median, which I think has something to do with the nature of the topic that is being talked. I don't mean this facetiously for age, but I think that the crowd that is talking the topic, I think, is important. Now, I come from South America, and I think that one point that has not been explored is the following. There's some view of the role that the diaspora has on Israel, but the other way around is also, I think, quite particularly important. My own country has the biggest diaspora of Palestinians, 400,000 versus 20,000 Jews. So whatever happens in Israel is not irrelevant to whatever happens in the country, and I thought that it would be an interesting point to brought up to the if it hasn't been discussed.
Yeah,
that
is it. I'd love to know more. Can you say something more? Would you be willing? Briefly, of course.
Country is Chile. I guess for weather reasons or whatever, but there was a huge immigration during the Turkish Ottoman Empire. So these are mainly Christian Arabs who for the last, until about 20 years ago, there was a country club that was called Syrian. Most were called Turks, like the Jews. But as of about, I would say, no, maybe 30 years ago, certainly the Palestinian topic came up, which before didn't exist. I mean, the people would come, you know, they would say, I come from Jerusalem, but they would never say they were Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it's becoming a topic. So my point is that the relation between what happens in one place, diaspora versus Israel, is much more entwined than just the spiritual aspect, which is very important, of course, but this is very practical point.
Thank you. Well, let me take this one briefly because I absolutely agree with you. And because we're talking about a phenomenon, and I think this is one of the many areas where Alan Wolf and Yehuda Kurtzer agree, a phenomenon of one people but multiple citizenships, right? That we who are in the diaspora have to understand that what we do or refrain from doing will have a range of consequences for the state of Israel and for Jews in the state of Israel. But conversely, what the state of Israel does can have a profound impact on the standing and even the daily lives of Jews in the diaspora. And one of the things that's so striking is the absence of formal and regular mechanisms to have a searching conversation about that mutual impact of these two different Jewish communities on each other. And I don't think it's a breach of manners to ask senior officials in the government of Israel whether they have thought about the impact of particular actions that they're taking for domestic reasons on the lives of Jews in the diaspora. I'm not saying that that would be a comfortable conversation, but I think increasingly it's a necessary one. So good question, and thank you for asking. We have time for, I think, two more questions, and I'm going to go to Mr. Mitchell in the front row. But keep it brief, please. Otherwise, I won't be able to get in the last question.
Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report, and I want to come back to the question that Professor Birnbaum started with, but try a different take. Those who are paying attention would suggest that the concept of two-state solution is as dead as it's ever been, and the likelihood that we're going to get there isn't much better, which if is true, means that in some period of time, Israel will be neither a Jewish state nor a democratic state. And my question is, how do the particularism and universalism components of what it means to be a Jewish human being, how does that work with Israel no longer being either Jewish or democratic?
Most of the time that I'm asked about the two-state solution, I reply by saying Ron Kurtzer. In this case, I don't think you're actually asking about the prospects of the two-state solution, but about the possibility of a scenario in which I'm still holding out hope that even in the absence of a two-state solution, there is an awareness by the political by especially Israel as a political actor. I'm not sure what to make of Abbas as a political actor today, and whether he has any ability to move forward this agenda. I still hold out hope that that doomsday scenario of a permanent legally entrenched occupation of the West Bank, which creates a scenario of permanent, you know, non-citizens under Israeli rule, the prospect of that is so concerning to Israel's standing in the international community that it won't quite get there, even as radical right-wing elements in Israeli society are kind of pushing to make that the case. I don't know what happens when the narrative that has currently exist about Israel as a Jewish and democratic state, as I understand it, operates on the premise that Israel is as Jewish as democratic principles allow and not the reverse. If that happens, if the reverse is true, that Israel is only as democratic as its Jewish character will allow, it puts it's an undue burden on those of us who believe that it's possible to live as a Jewish and democratic state. So I am basically still optimistic, not about the current political reality, but that the avoidance of that scenario is still an Israeli political and diplomatic imperative, and that they will create the conditions that make it possible to avoid that, whether it's through a different type of unilateral disengagement from portions of the West Bank that enable them to preserve a narrative of security or otherwise. But I'm not convinced that the Israeli political establishment will allow that to happen precisely because of the concerns that you're raising.
So not the wrong Kurtzer after all. Yes, sir, you get the last question.
This is Dr. Nisar Chaudhry with Parks and Rec League, and I really enjoy a distinction that I am the last man to ask the question. My question is that another friend also pointed out the Greek community, the Cuban community, the Jewish community in America, they are so well organized, and Jewish community is well entrenched, and there are so many organizations. I just wanted to know, when there are irritants between Israel, State of Israel, and United States governments, does this community or these organizations play a role to remove those irritants, and to which extent they do play a role? Does the State Department moves in to ask them to help them to remove the irritants, or the State of Israel come in to ask them to remove the irritants? Thank you.
I'm not sure I fully understood about the State Department.
In your, I mean, U.S. government.
U.S. government. In what context?
When there are irritants between the State of Israel and the United States of America
in their relationship, does this community, who has so much of influence, play a role in burnishing the rough edges or removing those irritants? That's the question.
Just a historical note, State Department itself was very filled to the brim with anti-Semites during the Hitler period, anything but actively behind the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. The Truman administration has now been very interesting historical works about it, but according to John Judas, who's here in Washington, D.C., in his new book, Truman's instincts and the State Department's instincts were against the recognition of the State of Israel at the time. I think the pressure really it comes from the American people much more than from the elite. And it's always been the case with respect to Israel. The explanation for why this country tends to be so pro-Israel is not just the influence of this lobby, but that it's a very, very, very popular cause in this country. Americans, Jewish and non-Jewish, you may even find more critics among the Jews these days than among the non-Jews. It's just an enormously popular cause. It's seen as a besieged democracy. However much anti-Semitism there may have been in the United States, there still remains, I think, a tremendous, I don't know if prejudice is the right word, fear of the Arab communities, and if it's a conflict between Muslims and Jews, most Christians would take the Jews over the Muslims and so on down the line.
One other thing I would add to that is, if I'm not mistaken, I believe that the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, which is kind of like the linchpin in that whole narrative, was, I think, created by Eisenhower out of a need to talk to one person and not a lot of people. I'm not even making that up. The reason why it's important is because it tells the story of an American Jewish community that was organized hierarchically in the 40s and 50s, but is simply not organized with the same type of hierarchy today. So to the extent that there is an attempt by Jews and by Americans and Americans who are Jews to ease the tensions or irritants, as you said, between the Israeli government and the American government, it is much less through a kind of pyramid organized hierarchical structure and more just because of the changing nature of American Jewish power. So.
Please join me in thanking this wonderful panel.